Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Almost all our live animal trade is with Canada and Mexico, and that differs by animal.
Talking international trade of live animals, Dr. Glenn Tonser, Kansas State livestock economist.
Briefly on hogs, there's a fair amount of wean pig and some market hog transactions, primarily with Canada. And some of our listeners are in that business, so they're going to be well aware of those effects. When it comes to cattle, we trade feeder cattle with both Mexico and Canada. We've had the screw room discussion about trade with Mexico that's relevant here as well. And then some fat cattle or finished cattle trade with Canada. We could have a parallel discussion there as well. But when it comes to live animal, it's almost exclusively with Canada and Mexico. And that has a lot to do with we have a North American integrated live animal system, and geographically they are countries that border us, so it makes sense.
This is Agriculture Today.
Right now, I think the producer has to be mindful of the way that the energy in the market has changed, if you will.
How to navigate today's markets, Chief Strategy Officer with AgMarket.net, Brian Splitt.
We went through a period of time, let's just call it, you know, fall into midwinter, the change of the calendar year, where there just wasn't a lot going on. The markets had very small trading ranges. When I say markets, I mean grain markets had small trading ranges. The day-to-day information flow was almost non-existent. There just wasn't a lot happening. And so now that we've kind of flipped the calendar into 2025, it started with the January report that really changed the perception of the balance sheet for corn specifically, but also for soybeans. And now we've got a new administration in office. And so with all of the things going on with tariffs and who are we putting tariffs on, are the tariffs off, are they getting delayed, right? So the frequency of what you would say impactful, market impacting information is really ramping up. And so that is causing an increase in volatility. And so I think the producer should consider how they participate in the market because of that. I've been doing this for quite some time, almost 20 years now, and I know how producers react to margin calls. Some of them are completely okay with it, but it's probably the 80-20 rule where 80% really don't enjoy them very much. And so I think you have to maybe reconsider the way that you are protecting yourself or the way that you're participating. I think right now, And last night's trade, or the Sunday night opening after the tariffs were announced, is a good example of how you can feel very right and then very wrong hours later. And so maybe futures aren't the tool for everybody right now. Options aren't that expensive yet, where they're pricing in a lot of volatility. So I think right now I feel the most comfortable putting producers in positions where we have time with the option, we know what we're spending on the option, we're pointing ourselves in the direction that we feel like we want to be. So maybe if we're focusing on just putting a floor under the market, we're going to use the chart, we're going to identify, hey, the market needs to get through this level to turn bearish, so let's have a put at that strike price and let's be bullish with our physical, leave the upside 100% open. But if the information flow changes and all of a sudden it's back to negative again, we can sleep at night. But I don't want to be in the market where I'm jumping in and out because the market's forcing me out or the information flow is changing and now I'm making decisions under duress, right? That's what I want to avoid.
Do we have a clear signal to plant corn over beans?
As of right now, the narrative is that we're gaining corn acres or have gained corn acres at the expense of soybeans. Now, the month of February is significant because we make our price average for spring for crop insurance purposes. So it'll be interesting to see what corn does and what new crop soybeans do over the month of February. I think there's a friendly pattern in the soybean chart. I talked about it when I did my technical presentation. And there may be a period here in the month of February where soybeans try to get some acres back. So I do still think it's a fluid situation. But again, to your point, it's not everybody's acres. There's probably some acres up in the northern plains, maybe some acres in the Delta. It's not, you know, your Iowa, Illinois, Indiana acres that are the ones that are up for grabs at this point. I think that's your typical rotation. So, you know, could we see acreage for corn maybe go back to the idea of, hey, maybe it's not 93, 94, 95, maybe it's 91, 92, 93, something like that? Absolutely, but I think it's going to require the soybean market doing a little bit of heavy lifting here in the short term.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So if you raise a steer, we get lots of beef items out of that. And those beef items go to the market where they're most valuable to the extent those markets are open.
It's Kansas State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonzer on international trade.
I usually use the example of tongue, is we export a lot of tongue and liver and so forth because they're worth more outside the U.S. than here, is a simple reminder. Why am I doing that to us? I'm a big believer as an economist that international trade allows countries and firms and individual producers in this example to better specialize and do what they have a comparative advantage in. And here in the U.S., we're really good at raising livestock and producing meat, but the extent we can do that effectively is a function of trade. I'm giving you all that because I have some concerns about what the latest announcements on tariffs might do in lots of fronts, but particularly on the ag commodity space. Specifically, what I'm alluding to there, and most of your listeners know this, is the U.S. has imposed 25% tariffs on goods that come in from Canada and Mexico, as well as a 10% flat on China. There's lots of discussion about why those numbers are not the same or in the order they are. I'm not going to get bogged down in that. That's a discussion for a different day. But I want to give some context on, like, kind of relevance and context on this. Quick overview. We do not have December of 2024 trade data yet. There's about a six-week lag on that. We'll have it in about 10 days. So I'm going to look back at calendar year 2023 just to give us context here. And in 2023, our beef imports, 27% of those came from Canada, 17% from Mexico. When we flip it over to exports, 9% of U.S. beef exports went to Canada, 10% went to Mexico. So when it comes to meat trade, Canada and Mexico on beef particularly are quite important. But we have several other trading partners that are also large. That's why those two numbers aren't over 100. I'm going to interject here some pork numbers. We normally talk beef and cattle, but the relative announcement I think is largest for Mexico and pork is why I want to do it. Pork imports are largely from Canada. 65% of our imports are from there, 8% from Mexico. We're not a large pork importing country, but we're a very large pork exporting country. And 38% of our exports in 2023 went to Mexico. The Mexican market had grown a lot in relevance in lots of ways. In 2023, we exported 2.5 billion more pounds to Mexico than we imported. So very much a net export relationship there. Word of warning is we got to be careful with that relationship as it relates to pork relevance. I made in my notes here just to remind a shout out, you know, hams is the product that's most relevant in that discussion. I try to give the example for cattle, you know, tongues and livers and so forth. We export the majority of. We export a lot more ham than we do, say, belly. We're more of a bacon-consuming country than a ham-consuming country here. Hams, historically, and it's been a growing market over time, have went towards Mexico. I'm interjecting that point also because I think you're going to see the ham market disrupted more than, say, the bacon market because it's more sensitive to international trade relations that are being affected as we speak. So the last thing I want to say there, and there's going to be a lot more on this coming week, is for those who want more context on this, in September of 2022, Darrell Peel, who our listeners know well at Oklahoma State, he and I were tasked with doing a report, and you find the full report. It's well over 60 pages, not for the light of heart, but it has a lot of figures and numbers in it, on Ag Manager, where we looked at what if the U.S. stopped beef trade. So in particular, we looked at the example of just slowing, so a 10% reduction in beef imports and exports. And I want to give the bottom line point was our work says prices and quantities will decline in that example. Cumulative net present value, so the econ term to kind of put a bow on the impact of that, over 10 years would be a loss of $12.9 billion to feeder cattle sellers. So think cow-calf, background, or stocker. And then $6.8 billion to those that sell fed cattle, so think feedlots. Those are billions with a B. Point is, these trade relations have developed over time because consumers in certain markets value those products more than domestically, and that's what we're in the process of testing. And the global market for beef and pork items is much larger than the domestic market.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We don't want fentanyl coming into our country.
Earlier in the week from the Oval Office, President Donald Trump.
Now, we had another big thing, speaking of China. China's involved with the Panama Canal. They won't be for long, and that's the way it has to be. Marco just got back, as you know. He's in the process of coming back. I guess he's almost back by now. And he had a very long conversation with the leader of Panama, the respected man, and some others, the entire leadership group. And we're trying to work a deal on the Panama Canal. The Panama Canal was given foolishly years ago to, it shouldn't have been happened, years ago to Panama by Jimmy Carter and the group. We lost 38,000 people, building the Panama Canal, like the one of the great wonders of the world. It's the biggest job we've ever built, the biggest project we've ever built in this country, dollar-wise and every other way. 38,000 people died, Americans, all men, just about, laborers and construction people that went to Panama. The mosquito got them. Between mosquito and snakes, we lost 38,000 people. It was the most expensive project ever built by the United States. Most, the biggest, most expensive project we ever built 110 years ago. If you bring it up to now, it would have been the equivalent of $2 trillion. The most expensive we ever built, and we gave it away for $1, okay? We gave it away essentially for nothing. And we either want it back, or we're going to get something very strong, or we're going to take it back. And China will be dealt with. And we didn't give that to China. We gave it to Panama. We shouldn't have given it to Panama. But Panama, as you know, has violated the agreement, totally violated the agreement. So that's in the process right now. But they did have a very good meeting with the head of Panama.
And the U.S. is meeting with Panama.
We're going to meet with Panama on Friday at about 3:30 in the afternoon by phone. And maybe there'll be some representatives at, you know, here or there. But we're going to be talking to Panama on Friday, essentially. And they've agreed to certain things, but I'm not happy with it.
And though there are a lot of skeptics, Trump says tariffs work.
I have great respect for Rupert Murdoch. I disagree with him a lot of times with the Wall Street Journal, but that's all right. We've disagreed before, but and I'm sure they didn't have any idea what they were talking about, because already you see what's happening. Look at Colombia. Look at what happened with that. Everybody said that with Colombia it was going to be a disaster. In one hour, everything was settled. You know why? Tariffs. Tariffs. Without tariffs, they wouldn't have been the same way. They would not have treated me the way they treated me, which was extremely nicely. And I don't want to use countries. I don't want to use names, but tariffs are very powerful, both economically and in getting everything else you want. Tariffs for us, nobody can compete with us because we're the pot of gold. But if we don't keep winning and keep doing well, we won't be the pot of gold, and then tariffs won't be so good for us. But when you're the pot of gold, the tariffs are very good. They're very powerful, and they're going to make our country very rich again.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The Ag Economy Barometer Index was up 5 points this month to a reading of 141, while the Index of Current Conditions was actually up 9 points compared to a month earlier. The Index of Future Expectations was up just 3 points compared to December at a reading of 156.
Dr. Jim Mentert is Professor Emeritus, Purdue University, on the latest Purdue CME Ag Economy Barometer.
Farm Financial Performance Index rose to a reading of 111. That's up compared to 98 in December and well above where it was back in September when the reading was just 68. We asked producers about their expectations for the size of their farm operating loan in 2025 compared to 2024. 18% of the respondents in this month's survey said they expected to have a larger operating loan this year than last year. That compares to 15% who felt that way a year ago. We followed up with those who expect to have a larger operating loan and asked them why that was the case. 23% of them said that it was because they were carrying over unpaid operating debt from the prior year. That's up from 17% who felt that way a year ago and up from just 5% who felt that way 2 years ago. Farm Capital Investment Index was unchanged this month at a reading of 48, while the Short-Term Farmland Value Expectation Index rose 5 points to a reading of 115 compared to 110 in December. That matches its reading from November of 2024. We asked producers how likely they think it is that U.S. agriculture is at risk of a trade war that results in a significant decrease in U.S. ag exports. 40% of the respondents in the January survey said they think a trade war is either likely or very likely. That's down somewhat from December when 48% felt that a trade war was either likely or very likely. We asked producers what their expectations are with respect to their biggest concern for their farming operation in the upcoming year. 39% of the respondents in this month's survey said higher input costs is their top concern, while 24% chose lower crop and or livestock prices. We asked several questions about leasing of farmland for solar energy production in this month's survey. 11% of the respondents in this month's survey said that they had had a discussion with a company about leasing farmland for solar energy production within the last 6 months. Among those who had engaged in discussions with companies, 40% said that they had received an offer of $1,250 or more per acre for leasing their farmland for solar energy production, and 26% said they were offered $1,500 per acre or more to lease farmland for solar energy production.
But future hasn't been looking too bright for the cotton industry. Cody Besant, Plains Cotton Growers.
Insurance goes through what's called the discovery price. So for us specifically, we will watch the December 2025 futures market right now through the month of February, and they'll take an average of those total closings each day for the month of February, and then that will set a discovery price for cotton specifically going into the new year. And a lot of folks use it for refinancing-based purposes. They know kind of where a de minimis or a guaranteed value is, levers against the producer's coverage level and APH, so that they can look at that for refinancing. Hopefully, we'll see an uptick in the market that will help set a more reasonable discovery price. Right now, we're sort of at the bottom, looking around 67, 68 cents the last couple of days as the markets have opened and closed, but hopefully it'll uptick higher as we get through the month of February so people can utilize that for refinancing purposes. And then in the fall, we do a harvest price discovery. It's in the month of October, very similar base process, but it looks at kind of the overall snapshot of the year and utilize that for any type of differences between the two, the discovery price now and the harvest price set in the fall.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
USDA AMS called the Fed cattle market on Friday at 209. That continues the strong strength to start here 2025. That's up maybe $5 on the week, depending on exactly what day and hour I would do some comparisons on.
Kansas State livestock economist Glenn Tonser.
When we look over at feeder cattle, AMS called the auctions $5 to $15 higher, depending on exactly what, you know, weight class we talk about. Two example lots here from Kansas sales. 63 head weighing 681 went for 313. 122 head weighing 822 went for 263. Now, those are the cash numbers, and they were quite strong this past week. When you look over to the board, so CME contracts, they were more flat. Not weakness there, but there wasn't the same amount of strength. So February live cattle was 204, more or less flat on the week. Here I'll interject, you know, that's up from 191 early in January. So, you know, we're four, almost 5 weeks into the year, and we've already gained, you know, $15 there in the trade. There's a strong tone there. Feeder cattle is more of that point. March feeder cattle closed 276 on Friday, down about a dollar for the week, but it was also at 263 the first week of January. So I'm interjecting those as not only are these year-over-year gains just since the calendar year started, the cattle market has improved quite a bit. When we look over at boxed beef, so get to wholesale trade, choice boxed beef was called at 328 on Friday, basically flat with the prior Friday, and select was 317, up a dollar. And I think the entire trade now is convinced and kind of moving on from uncertainty on tight numbers. I think that's in here. We'll talk some beef demand stuff. It continues to be better than we thought. Not big surprises. I think a little bit more of the same, but a lot more volatility is coming, and we're going to talk trade here in a minute. But please note, I haven't said anything about margins yet. Those are just prices, and the cost of doing business may well increase beyond what we expect here in 2025.
And what about the recent cattle inventory report?
This is one of the key reports that USDA gives us every year. On January 31st each year is the January cattle inventory report, and I'm reminding folks what this is for a reason, is A, complete your surveys when USDA asks you to. More quality of information coming in makes these reports better, is the point of that. The January report gives us a national snapshot and a state-by-state snapshot of several things in the live animal cattle side of things here. USDA estimates we started this calendar year at 27.9 million beef cows nationally. That'd be down 1% from last year, right on par with what most were expecting before the report. When you look at, there's seven states that have over a million beef cows. Kansas is one of those. Four of those states were up, but up very small. Missouri, Montana, Oklahoma, and Texas were up 1%, in the case of Missouri, 2%, so very small increases in beef cow numbers. Nebraska and South Dakota were down 3%, and then Kansas was flush, like literally 50,000 cows different, which is a rounding error different here. Put a bow on that is the leading states, the larger states, are a net zero, consistent with nationally we're a net zero, you know, maybe 1% lower on beef cow numbers compared to last year. You know, so the beef cow number says we hadn't previously done it because the cows weren't in the system yet that had grown. And then we look at intentions around beef replacement heifers. Those numbers were down 1%. So we started this year with USDA estimates 4.67 million head. As I said, down about 1% from last year. So not only have we yet to start expansion, we actually contracted a little bit more in 2025. My very broken crystal ball, Shelby, is this coming summer, you know, so 5-6 months from now, there will be some operations that start the process of rebuilding and expanding. But when I look forward to the January 2026 report, I think it's going to show very small, like, you know, net neutral, maybe 0.5% growth in cows at the moment. So very small interest in expansion. And best guess at the moment is it'll be the summer of 2026 when we have a lot more heifers held out. So I think we're still, you know, maybe 18 months away from nationally relevant market moving herd expansion.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, he's got access only to letting people go that he thinks are no good if we agree with him. And it's only if we agree with him.
Talking about Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency. President Donald Trump from the Oval Office.
He's a very talented guy from the standpoint of management and costs. And we put him in charge of seeing what he can do with certain groups and certain numbers. The numbers, some of the numbers are horrible, what he's found. $100 million on condoms to Hamas. Condoms to Hamas. And many other things that are frankly even more ridiculous. And they're finding tremendous waste. More than anything else, I think you could say. Probably fraud and abuse can be added to it. The more standard waste, fraud, and abuse. But they're finding tremendous amounts of really bad things, bad spending. You've been reading about, you've been writing about some of it, frankly, and some of the things that they've been doing is just terrible. Elon can't do and won't do anything without our approval. And we'll give him the approval where appropriate. Where not appropriate, we won't. But he reports in, and it's something that he feels very strongly about, and I'm impressed because he's running, obviously, a big company. It has nothing to do if there's a conflict that we won't let him get near it. But he does have a good natural instinct. He's got a team of very talented people. We're trying to shrink government. And he can probably shrink it as well as anybody else, if not better. Where we think there's a conflict or there's a problem, we won't let him go near it. But he has some very good ideas, and we have a lot of very other talented people also. We're bringing in the most talented people in the world. By the way, we just unrelated, but we have two of the most talented people in the world, the legendary Rupert Murdoch and Larry Ellison. So they are two legends in business, publishing, and probably every other. Rupert is, Larry, pretty much in a class by himself, right? I mean, although he may have a couple of bucks more. I don't know. But Rupert is in a class by himself. He's an amazing guy. And Larry is Larry. Larry is one of the most serious players anywhere in the world. So it's an honor to have you.
Trump also says if Canada wants more from the U.S., maybe they need to become a state.
We have big deficits with Canada, like we do with all countries. I mean, I look at some of the deals made, I say, who the hell made these deals that are so bad? But with Canada, but look, what I'd like to see, Canada become our 51st state. We give them protection, military protection. We don't need them to build our cars. I'd rather see Detroit or South Carolina or any one of our Tennessee, any one of our states build the cars. They could do it very easily. We don't need them for the cars. We don't need them for lumber. We don't need them for anything. We don't need them for energy. We have more energy than they do. We don't need them for energy. So I say, why are we doing this? Why are we willing to lose between $100 billion and $200 billion a year? We don't need them. As a state, it's different. As a state, it's much different. And there are no tariffs. So I'd love to see that, but some people say that would be a long shot. If people wanted to play the game right, it would be 100% certain that they'd become a state. but a lot of people don't like to play the game because they don't have a threshold of pain. And there would be some pain, but not a lot.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Taking the barometer of dairy farmers and processors in the United States, we'd see more subtle smiles these days.
Corey Geiger is a dairy economist with CoBank.
Dairy is dynamic and growing. It's a $76 billion category in the grocery aisle, and it's larger than any other category, including alcohol, which includes wine, beer, and all the spirits. So from that standpoint, it's growing. Certainly, there's going to be tribulations along the way here. 16 to 17% of our dairy products go to export in the United States. So with the word tariff coming about and some, you know, issues in that area, we might see a little bit of slowed sales. But the upward trajectory in the dairy industry is strong. And actually, in 2024, milk beverage sales, fluid milk, were actually stable. So if we could stabilize that category and see great growth in cheese and butter and whey proteins, it's a bright future.